This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says Wisconsin's education funding isn't meeting the needs of rural schools.
First, Ray Tensing, the former University of Cincinnati police officer accused of shooting motorist Samuel DuBose, has been indicted this week on murder charges.
The incident is the latest in a string of white police officers killing unarmed black people. In this case, former officer Tensing was wearing a body camera during the fatal traffic stop, and the footage appears to contradict his version of events.
The case has sparked more national discussion about the way minority communities are treated by police, the use of police body cameras, and police traffic stop procedures.
We're joined now by Charles Epp, a professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Kansas. He's also the author of Pulled Over, How Police Stops Define Race and Citizenship. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, this incident, this latest with Samuel DuBose, how does this fit into your research?
Well, what's striking about this case, as in the case of Sandra Bland and also Walter Scott, in each of these stops, the officer probably was stopping the driver, in this case Samuel DuBose, just to check him out. That is, the justification for the stop was really a minor one. In fact, the prosecutor in Hamilton County there called it a pretty chicken crap stop, his words. Typically, I will say white drivers are not stopped for minor reasons like this. In our research, we find that black drivers are commonly stopped for very minor reasons, and then the officer proceeds to ask questions like, what are you doing in the neighborhood? Is this your car? And things like that. And not uncommonly, the officer then proceeds on to carry out a search of the vehicle. And in each one of these stops, of course, as we know, things escalated badly after that initial interaction in which the officer asked some questions. And we find in our research as well that although black drivers and officers generally try to avoid these kinds of escalations, sometimes they do happen. And when they do happen, tragedies sometimes result.
Now, you use the phrase, check him out, and there's a more formal phrase that you've used in your research. Like, I think that term is investigatory stop. So what normally happens on an investigatory stop, and what are police looking for at that moment?
Yeah, officers use these stops to check for illegally carried weapons and illegal drugs, or also just information about what the driver is up to. Officers will generally have some sort of legal justification for making the stop, but that's not hard to come by. Most of us sometimes don't signal a lane change, as in the case of Sandra Bland, or have some minor vehicle defect or something like that. So the officer has a justification for making the stop, walks up and may announce that justification, but then very quickly proceeds to ask questions and also look around the visible contents of the vehicle. And what we find in our research is a pretty clear pattern. If the officer's curiosity is quickly addressed, resolved, the officer may let the driver go with nothing more than a warning or with a ticket for a very minor violation. But if their curiosity is further piqued, they may proceed further and further, and as I said a moment ago, may request or demand a search of the vehicle. Along the way, in our research, drivers commonly told us that as the stop proceeds further, if it does, they are subjected to a handcuffing, even if they're never arrested in the end and let go. So these stops can go on for quite a while if the officer's curiosity is not satisfied or if he or she sees something that they think indicates a serious illegality. But in any case, it's a very uncomfortable experience for the person being stopped. And as I say, commonly the people subjected to these kinds of stops are African Americans, less commonly whites.
We're talking right now with Charles Epp, professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Kansas, also author of the book Pulled Over, talking about the Samuel DuBose shooting and police policy and procedures. Now, if a person is pulled over by a police officer, do they have a legal right to refuse that officer access to their vehicle beyond what the officer can see, say, with a flashlight?
That's a very good question, and the answer to that is actually complicated. They have a legal right not to give consent for that search, but if the officer asserts that he or she has seen some probable cause that would justify, you know, legally justify the search, then the officer may proceed to make that search without that consent. But what we find, and other studies have found as well, is that in some 90 to 95% of vehicle searches, the officer has gained the right to do that search by asking for consent and by getting that consent from the driver. And the driver does have the right to refuse consent. That's very clear. Now, I will say the practical reality is most people in this situation feel that they have no choice but to consent. They think it'll just get worse if they don't. So they say, yeah, sure, go ahead, even if they would much rather it not happen.
Now, in this case, things unfolded the way they did in the indictment because of a body cam that that officer was wearing. How do you see that changing the landscape of this kind of interaction between police and minority communities?
Well, it's still a bit too early to tell, but there are now several studies that have looked at the effect of body cameras on these tense interactions between people in stops. And what they find is, generally speaking, the presence of body cameras reduces the number of complaints against officers. And one study found a significant reduction in use of force by officers when the body camera is present and in operation. Now, as I say, it's probably still too early to declare case closed. We know that body cameras solve this problem. I don't think that they do. It's a complicated question, but the evidence at this point is suggesting that officers behave better in these tense interactions when they know that their actions, their words, are being recorded by a camera.
Now, you've called for a severe scale back to this kind of investigatory stop. How do you think that would help in this situation?
Well, as I say, this stop is used much more commonly against black drivers than against white drivers. It also is used much more commonly against young drivers than older drivers and against men than women. So there are some clear biases in the use of this type of stop. The vast majority of people who are subjected to these stops, both white as well as black, but especially black drivers who experience them commonly, feel indignant at the experience, feel that they have been harassed, sometimes feel that they've been abused by the process, and their trust in the police goes down as a result of this. Also, the vast majority of these stops yield nothing, no illegally carried weapon, no illegal contraband of any sort. And so, on balance, we argue this type of police procedure is much more harmful than it is helpful to the policing mission. It harms the people who are stopped, and it harms the police who are trying to gain the trust of the public and get their help in fighting crime. And for all of these reasons, we argue in the book, and we have a lot of evidence to support it, that policing would be better off and our communities would be better off without the widespread use of these stops.
Now, when we're talking explicitly here about this kind of traffic stop, what else do you think needs to change? You'd like police to stop using this sort of stop as often. Anything else that you think should be a big point of interest for police as they move forward and try to improve their relationship between the force making these traffic stops and the people who are being stopped?
Two things that I would recommend. One is a concerted effort to train officers to deal respectfully with members of the public in every stop. Respectful treatment goes a long way toward rebuilding trust in the police, and it is one of the most significant complaints that African-American drivers have about police officers in stops. But as we argue in the book, respectful treatment isn't enough. A very respectful officer can carry out a highly intrusive stop, and in that case, the driver is indignant over the experience of the stop, even if the officer is impeccably polite. So respectful treatment is important, but not enough. The second thing is, I have come to believe, as a result of these recent studies, that body cameras may go some distance toward helping to address this problem as well. But I will say again that, like respectful treatment, a body camera is not enough, because officers may go completely by the book in making a stop like this and do nothing that violates any rule and still carry out an intrusive stop that a driver finds to be harassment, simply put. So several things. The bottom line is we're convinced, my co-authors and I, that the only way to address this problem in the end is to really significantly rein in these investigatory stops that lead to these intense encounters that sometimes escalate into tragedies.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Charles Epp, a public affairs expert, talking about the impact of the Samuel DeBose shooting on police policy and procedures. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Our guest says the funding level for rural schools in Wisconsin is hurting kids, with issues of building maintenance, special education services, and staffing on his mind. He wrote in a recent piece, "The interesting thing about having less is that you can't do more, and you can't even do the same. You can only do less." Luke Francois joins us now. He's the superintendent of the Mineral Point School District. Luke, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Luke, as you see it, where is funding right now for your district, Mineral Point?
Well, funding right now is really flat from the state, in that this year there was no increase into revenue limits, and so therefore there's really no new money coming into schools. The increases that you saw for education were actually passed into property taxes and giving some local community relief, but there's really no new monies to operate schools. And then when we have increased expenditures such as transportation or insurance or salaries and so forth, we don't have any new dollars to cover those increases, so we're actually looking at what I would consider an overall reduction that we had to make this year.
And you read that levels right now are comparable to funding levels from the year 2009. Have things changed much since then in terms of the cost that you have to keep the schools up and running?
Yeah, just like anything in today's world, things cost much more than they did in 2009. Back in the 1990s and into the early 2000s, you could count on a per pupil revenue increase of around $200 to $250. And post Act 10, we received a reduction of $600 per student. And the legislation has put in some increases over the past 4 years to get us back to 2009 limits. But as I just mentioned, everything is more expensive today and continues to go up in pricing. And therefore, we're consistently making reductions in order to try to get back to 2009. Even post or pre-Act 10, we had already made many of those reductions. We had eliminated programs. Our employees were already making a contribution to their health care at 10%. And so we just didn't have the resources available to make further reductions beyond what was already made pre-2010.
And as you talk to your colleagues in education and other public schools in Wisconsin and rural districts, is the Mineral Point situation similar to other schools that you're hearing about?
Yes, Mineral Point represents half of the schools across the state that have 1,000 students or less. And we are all in a very similar situation. I think Mineral Point might be in a unique situation in that we were forced to go to referendum upon my arrival. We had a $1.1 million structural deficit just to keep our building doors open and operating as we wanted them to. We were fortunate that we passed a recurring referendum in Mineral Point, which puts us in a unique situation, much like other districts where they were forced to, in order to keep their funding levels consistent, go to the community and ask for support. But not all of our rural schools across the state have been successful in passing referendums, and that puts them in even a worse situation to try to continue to offer opportunities for kids at the same levels as some of our more affluent suburban areas.
You point out that there are some key differences between urban schools and rural schools. What role do you see public schools playing in a rural community?
Well, rural schools have a very unique niche that they can carve out. Certainly, there's personalization that can happen on a very individual level. We have very few students, 750 students, K-12, and so that roughly puts you a class of 55 or 60 students. And that allows us that personalization to really get into and focus on students' needs. But on the other side of that, though, we have probably about six students that have English language learners that are English is not their primary language. And so it's hard to put a full-time teacher in place to service just six kids, where if you have 120 kids, it's easy to put full-time resources in a larger suburban school. So that's some of the challenges that we have to mitigate, is how do we service our smaller population of kids with what will require full-time teaching equivalencies.
And in terms of the community at large, is a rural school more of a focal point in a smaller community than it might be in a big urban center?
I believe in every community, certainly their high school is a big piece of their community, and everybody rallies around the Friday night football games or the basketball games in the winter, but it seems to be even more prevalent in a small rural town because there are not a lot of other opportunities that that you have for kids and families to get together and rally and discuss with the community just the happenings of the day, and it seems to happen more often around sporting events, musical performances, and such and the like. So with that said, you know, I think there is a little bit more of a prominence around small rural schools rallying behind their local districts.
We're talking right now with Luc Francois. He's the superintendent for the Mineral Point School District, talking about challenges facing rural schools as far as funding goes. And you talked a bit about special education, and this is one area that you're particularly concerned about, the flat funding you mentioned being felt. Where are you most worried about the flashpoints there?
Well, certainly our special education population and students that have needs are probably one of our most costly areas to try to fund an appropriate education. And in order to do that, we need certainly the appropriate level of funding, but increased funding as the expenses to service kids that have occupational needs, physical therapy needs, significant disabilities are pretty costly. And for, I believe, the eighth or ninth straight year, the Wisconsin State Legislature has frozen special education funding. And so we haven't seen an increase in quite some time. And again, we're just being asked to do more and more without the appropriate resources to educate kids fully to the extent that we can.
And you point out in your piece that with the new budget, the funding follows the students. So more money could end up going to voucher schools, for instance, and leaving the Mineral Point School District as an example. How do you see that having the potential to impact your school district?
Well, last year in the state funding formula, right off of the top, money goes towards the voucher program. And then what's remaining is divided among the schools across the state. For Mineral Point, that was a $72,000 loss to the Milwaukee public voucher system. And that was a real significant loss of revenue before we even started to work through some of our challenges. That in itself would put a teacher in place that could support reading efforts, that could support other part-time teachers, that we could make them whole again to support our schools in other ways. So there is a significant opportunity, I think, if we really look at this in a different way.
And again, are you hearing that same kind of thing from other rural schools?
We are, especially in the southwestern part of the state. My counterparts would agree that when we talk about equal access to education and equal opportunities in education, that there certainly isn't an equal opportunity, that some of our affluent, high tax-paying communities just are afforded the ability to have more resources available to educate their kids than small rural communities that maybe don't have the same property tax base.
And then you talk about maybe consolidating some of these smaller districts, pooling resources, and using that as a way to make the money go further.
Certainly, consolidation is something that comes up in rural schools, but the hub of a community really is its school district. And as soon as you start to talk about folding community school districts together, you start to lose your true identity about what that means to be from Mineral Point or from some of the area schools. And so certainly there's a financial upside to that, but there's a community resistance, I believe, to lose their identity into something that's a bigger conglomerate.
Now, building maintenance, I know, is a concern for you, and you mentioned air conditioning in the summer. What kinds of things do you think might have to wait if the funding isn't there?
Well, there's many things that have waited and will continue to wait. We're no longer on a parking lot replacement schedule. We now have boilers that are aging that need to be replaced. We literally can see flames through the side of our hot water heater if we went down into our basement. We have asbestos underneath our tiles in the elementary building that was built in the 60s, and we are only able to afford to probably replace two of those rooms a year, and we've got another 12 to go, so six more years, and maybe we'll get caught up on some of our capital expenditures. But there needs to be a significant shift in how we fund schools, especially capital projects, in order for us to be more successful in keeping a 21st century environment learning for our kids.
And let's talk a little bit about that, the environment for the kids. Now, these things you could look at and say, well, they're cosmetic. It might not be the prettiest school, but the important thing is the learning. How does that impact the learning?
Yeah, so many of our learning spaces are really very different than when we went to school, and specifically with technology and some of the increases that are needed there to make sure that we have enough technology for our kids to access tablets or computers, as well as making sure our wireless infrastructure is strong, that we have good connections, that we have good uptime, because nothing will stop a teacher with using technology quicker than if a lesson goes down. So those are some significant investments that need to happen in order for us to stay current and traditional, as well as just learning spaces that are bright and airy and colorful for kids.
Now, at the end of your piece, you write that Wisconsin is no longer fulfilling its constitutional mandate to provide the financial basis for equal educational opportunity for all kids. Going back to the constitutional mandate, what do you mean by that?
Well, in about 15 years ago, Vincent versus Voight had a decision, and that court case basically stated that the current equalized funding formula for the state of Wisconsin was constitutionally sound. But if it's constitutionally sound, then we wouldn't see the disparities that we're seeing across the state with regards to the amount of revenue per student that schools have available to them. And we simply, again, get back down to, we just simply can't offer the same things that some of our larger school counterparts are offering. And in that equalization aid formula, it's very complex, but it simply just doesn't afford the same opportunities. And there's lots of areas that rural schools across the state could point to that says we just simply don't have that in our school because we can't afford it.
And Luke, just briefly, what would you like to see change in the coming years?
Well, certainly, the can has been kicked down the road for many years with addressing the equalization aid formula. And Dr. Evers, our state superintendent, has offered a solution, which is called fair funding for our schools. And I think for once and for all, our state just really needs to fix the funding formula. It's been something that has been talked about and studied, and I participated in testimony on the Rural Schools Task Force, but nothing has ever come out of it to actually make a change in how we fund schools.
Luke, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Luke Francois is the superintendent for the Mineral Point School District. He joined us to talk about challenges facing funding for rural schools.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This time of year, gardens and farmers markets are overflowing with fresh veggies like cucumbers, zucchini, radishes, and more. There's such a bounty of these foods that it can be hard to know what to do with them all.
For this week's edition of Food Friday, we're focusing on pickling. Our guest says cucumbers aren't the only things you can pickle, not even vegetables. She even has a recipe for pickled strawberries.
And we're taking your calls on this. What's your favorite food to pickle? What advice do you have to make it easier? And any questions about how pickling is done? You could call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Christina Ward is with us now. She's the Master Food Preserver for Milwaukee County and a writer for Edible Milwaukee and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with definitions. When we think of a pickle, I might think of a cucumber. It's in a salty, vinegary thing. You say there's a much wider definition. What all can we pickle?
There's a lot of you can pickle. What you can do is fruits, vegetables. You can even pickle eggs, the great Wisconsin bar tradition of pickled eggs. And if you've walked into a bar in Milwaukee, you may even see pickled pig hocks. So really, it's only limited to your imagination.
And you liken the search for the crispiest, perfect pickle to the search for the Holy Grail. How long have pickles been around?
Pickles, one of the oldest food preservation techniques, aside from salting, jerky making, which comes first. So pickling is essentially an alchemical reaction. So there's art and there's science. So what's happening is we're changing the acidity of food, primarily with vinegars, and by raising the acidity, it makes it impervious to germs and to pathogens. And so as soon as people figured out, without understanding the actual science, that sour foods lasted longer, they started making their food sour.
And how many different regional variations of pickled foods are there?
Every society that, in my research, has a variation on pickled foods. Now, there's also a variation on pickled foods that essentially is a lacto-fermentation. And if we think about sauerkraut, sour pickles, so lactic acid essentially forms the same types of souring in a pickle. So even when you get into the Arctic regions and you think about lutefisk, that's essentially a fermented pickle.
Before we go any further, can we get a little definition here of exactly what pickling is?
Absolutely. Pickling is very much the process. Here in Wisconsin, we tend to use a shorthand and refer to pickles as pickled cucumbers. But pickling is the process where a pickling solution, again, primarily of highly acidic, is used to suspend a fruit or a vegetable. And then the pickling process is where the liquid that's in the fruit or vegetable is exchanged with that pickling solution.
We're talking to Christina Ward. She's the master food preserver for Milwaukee County, a seasonal Food Friday conversation about pickling. Now, Christina, when I think of pickling, a lot of times I'll think of, you know, you've got the hot pot and you're processing the jars. It takes a while. It heats up the kitchen. In a recent piece, you wrote about quick pickling. What are the secrets to making quick pickles?
Essentially, the pickling process can happen whether it is hot water processed or in the refrigerator or freezer. And so what we're doing when we're putting something in a jar and then putting it in a hot water bath canner is essentially we're taking an additional food preservation step and pushing out all the oxygen, creating this anaerobic environment to make it safer for shelf stability, long-term storage. When we do the pickling process without the hot water bath, we're putting it in the refrigerator. We have a shorter amount of lifespan for the food, but it stays for about 3 to 4 weeks.
I made some pickled carrot and daikon last summer, and it was the first time I'd ever done that, but I wasn't sure how long I could keep it, not like a preserve or the actual canning process, which it seems like you can keep for a very long time. How long can you keep things that you quick pickle?
Quick pickles will vary in their life in the fridge, but a good rule of thumb is about 3 to 4 weeks in the refrigerator. Of course, that varies a little bit depending on how cold you keep your fridge.
Let's get into some recipes here, and this one I wouldn't have left to mind for me with pickling, pickled strawberries. How do we make those? What kind of things are mixed in for flavor?
Some of the fun part is when you're hot water bath processing pickles for long-term storage, some of the criticality of those measurements of the types of vinegar, the salts, the sugars are really important. That's the science part. When you're doing refrigerator pickles, you have a little bit more freedom. So you can take something lovely like a champagne vinegar, make your pickling solution with that, or red wine vinegar, and then essentially add a little extra flavor with some herbs, with some other spices. In this particular recipe, we used a little black pepper. And essentially cut your strawberries, hull them, meaning take the green top off, and then submerge them in your jar with your pickling solution. Strawberries have a lot of actual moisture in them, so that exchange happens quite fast. So it's something, if you made pickled strawberries in the morning, you could serve them for dinner that evening.
And Christina, I got to ask, I don't think I've ever eaten a pickled strawberry. What do they taste like? Do they still have that strawberry flavor?
They sure do. And that's one of the an idea to kind of correct a little bit in our own thinking about what pickles are, because we're so used to pickled cucumbers. Just as you can have a savory pickle, you can make a sweet pickle. And pickled strawberries are made with a sugar and vinegar pickling solution versus a salt and vinegar pickling solution. So a pickled strawberry, or my favorite, pickled pineapple, comes as a really sweet and sour taste, along with that fruit taste.
So to go with pickled fruit like that, what would you serve it with?
Well, I'm in Milwaukee, so one of my favorites is you go to Leon's Custard and you get vanilla custard, and you put your pickled fruit on top. So that works well with any type of local custard. But again, the healthier part is, especially now as the greens are coming in from everybody's gardens and farmers markets, throwing a couple pickled strawberries on top of a green salad is just a wonderful way to add some quick flavor. They also work really well if you're doing a cheese and sausage tray as a little addition to give a little umami, a little sourness, helps with the transfer the flavors when you're doing with the fats and the sausage in the sausages and the cheeses.
And let's talk about the basic standby, cucumbers, pickled cucumbers, the pickle, as you mentioned, we often call it. Assuming we don't want to go through the whole rigmarole of processing, what's a good tip for a quick cucumber pickle?
A lot of times what people are looking for with a pickled cucumber is to have that freshest, crunchiest taste. The equivalency would be in the grocery store if you're buying like a Clausen brand. And quick pickles is the way to get that. And so one of the things to do is to make sure you're using the freshest cucumber available. You'll hear so many wives' tales about tricks you can add, you can do, about things, you know, that, you know, do it under the full moon even. I've seen old recipes. But really, the secret is using the freshest cucumbers possible, the freshest dill possible, and just working with speed and purpose, and you will get really good, crisp dill pickles, or refrigerator dill pickles, or bread and butter pickles.
We're talking about pickling with Milwaukee County's master food preserver, Christina Ward.
And we're taking your calls on this. What is your pickling secret? What are your favorite spices to work with? And what is your favorite food to pickle? If you've got any questions, we've got an expert ready to answer them. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
While you're there, check out a great pickling recipe. I think it's bread and butter cucumber pickles. We'll pick up the discussion and get your calls in just a few moments after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now about pickling with Milwaukee County's master food preserver, Christina Ward.
And we're taking your calls, too. Do you have questions about pickling? Do you make pickles at home? What is your favorite? Do you do them quick, you know, in the fridge, or do you set up the whole processing station, get them hot, and save them for a couple of years? What is your favorite recipe? What's your favorite thing to pickle, and how do you serve them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Christina, I wonder if you can help me out. This is the time of year where I have, and I'm not alone here, I have a lot of zucchini lying around. Is there a pickle use for zucchini, or do they just kind of fall apart in the jar?
Actually, zucchini work really, really well. Especially the bread and butter pickle recipe that you referenced earlier, you can easily substitute zucchini for that. The other favorite to do is a hot dog relish, and you can do that quickly in the fridge. That's a pickle. You're just chopping up your zucchini and putting it right in the jar with all the other good ingredients, and you've got hot dog relish for the best of the picnics for the summer.
Oh, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Now, one thing is the sort of equipment we might need to get this done. You mentioned something called a pickling crock. What is that, and do we absolutely have to have one?
A pickling crock is a very primitive type of kitchen tool, and traditionally made of a stoneware, a ceramic. They get handed down through generations, though you can definitely buy them new. And what the stoneware does is insulate the food in the crock. And so if you have one, great. If you don't, one of my favorite things to use when we do it, teach pickling in class, is we use a food safe 5-gallon bucket. So a good old food-safe plastic bucket will work just the same way as a crock does.
Now, is that if you're doing a giant batch of them, or could you just do it in your little mason jar?
The buckets work really well for big batches. You can buy a smaller bucket for smaller batches. If you're just going to do a very small batch, you can do it in a mason jar. I would recommend at least a quart or a two-quart, what they refer to usually as the half-gallon jars.
Let's go to our callers. We've got Samantha on the line in Madison now. Samantha, hi.
Hi there. So I have a question. I just read online that you can create your vinegar solution and create a much larger batch than what you're about to pickle at a time. And then, so I just did this last night, actually. I processed the extra solution so that it's canned and on the shelf. As my vegetables come in, I already have a quart of the vinegar solution ready to go. I just heat it up and pour it over the vegetables. Does that sound doable? I've never done it before.
It sounds doable, but let me make a note of caution. Refer back to the University of Wisconsin Extension Office for all processing times. When you're hot water processing something, that's actually a scientific calculation. What you're processing, the size of the jar, the headspace, and how long you should process it for. It's not just a made-up number. So my question to you would be, how long did you process that for?
Samantha?
15 minutes.
15 minutes.
15 minutes in what size jar?
Quart.
You're good to go.
Yay.
So, but that's a note of caution for everyone. Take a look. There's free recipes and resources at the University of Wisconsin Extension that gives safe and tested recipes. So you can work ahead and you can know exactly what you need to do in the ratios and never have to worry about whether, you know, you're going to accidentally poison yourself or your family.
Samantha, thanks a lot, and good luck with that. And we're going to move on to Chuck joining us in La Crosse. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. I make hop shoot pickles.
Hops? Sorry, what was it?
Hop shoot pickles.
Hop shoot pickles. Have you heard about those, Christina?
I have. I'm coming to your house for Bloody Marys. That is, they're great in a Bloody Mary. And that's, I recommend it to folks when you're thinking about making pickles, is if you can imagine it in a Bloody Mary, then you can pickle it.
Anything tricky about that, Chuck, or did it turn out just as you imagined?
No, it's been very popular. I usually use a little bit of dill, which is hard to get in the spring, a little bit of garlic, and then coriander seed. But it's sort of a different time of the year. You think about making pickles about this time of the year, and instead you're making pickles in April and May.
That's fantastic. What a great idea to try those in a Bloody Mary. We're talking to Christina Ward, Master Food Preserver for Milwaukee County, getting great advice for pickling all the produce that's coming up now. Maybe some things we wouldn't have thought of pickling. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or on the Central Time Facebook page. Christina, before we get back to the callers, you mentioned some safety issues. Assuming we've followed those guidelines and done it right, how long can we eat the pickles that we've processed and the pickles that we've just done in the fridge?
Fridge pickles last about 3 to 4 weeks, depending on how cold you keep your fridge. The official scientific recommendation from the University of Wisconsin for processed pickles is 1 year. So everybody make a note on top of your jar when you made your pickles so you know when you need to eat them by.
Oh, good to know. All right, let's go back to our callers now. Matt is joining us in Madison. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. I just had a comment on the most delicious pickled food item that I've ever tasted. My partner is Indian American, and his mother recently brought us back a jar of very, very spicy pickled unripe mangoes from a trip to India.
Wow.
And they're just incredibly, incredibly delicious, but also very spicy.
So they're spicy. What else is in there besides the unripe mango? Do you have any idea, Matt?
I think there's a lot of different kind of Indian spices that you'd eat in like a typical curry. So karam is one of them. Some garam masala, a lot of those kind of rich, spicy Indian flavors. But I'm not sure what the process was or what else goes into this kind of a secret family recipe, I think. But they're just amazing.
Fantastic. That's a great one, Matt. And thank you, Christina. So unripe mangoes, does that spark anything that sounds like what you've tried?
I love exploring Indian pickling. And that's part of the fun of doing the research with the writing part of what I do, is exploring all the different food cultures. And the great thing about Wisconsin is we have so many of those food cultures coming to us through our immigrant populations. And so I always recommend to folks, if you're going to the farmer's market, if you're going to a so-called ethnic grocery store, ask questions. If you see a jar or something on the shelf that looks a little exotic or strange to you, ask about it. You might find something like pickled mangoes that becomes your new favorite thing ever.
Thanks a lot for the call, Matt. We'll go next to Elizabeth with us in West Salem. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello, good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about, Elizabeth?
Well, I wanted to tell you about my daughter's refrigerator pickles, and they are my absolute favorite. I used to be having dill pickles as my favorite, but since she made these, I just will not go for any others. And I stand and eat them out of the pickle container in the refrigerator before I ever stir them up. But it's a real simple recipe. 2 cups of sugar, 1 cup of vinegar. Bring to a boil, stirring, and then let it go back down. And then when it's settled down, add a tablespoon of celery seed and a teaspoon of salt. And mix that all well together, pour over your cucumbers, and leave them in the refrigerator for 2 weeks. And, oh, my goodness.
That sounds
absolutely luscious.
Sounds great, Elizabeth. So it can be that easy. And Christina, it sounds like we could do a lot of experimenting with our spices, and it's not going to take a whole lot of extra effort to try that.
Absolutely. And I'm listening to Elizabeth's recipe, and I can see she's got a sweet tooth. So that pickling solution is very much in the line of like a bread, what we call a bread and butter pickle. And so it'll have a really sweet taste to it, sweet sour. But she made an important point when she was reciting her recipe about leaving it in the refrigerator for 2 weeks. And this goes goes back to what we were talking about, what pickling is, and that exchange of the moisture that's in the fruit or vegetable with the actual pickling solution. So if you ate those cucumbers with the pickling solution the day after, it would just taste like, you know, vinegary cucumbers. And so you need to wait for a prescribed amount of time for the actual pickling to occur. And so when we're also talking about storage time, so that's kind of the shorthand with canners, with food preservationists. So keep it 3 to 4 weeks in the refrigerator, and that's after about the 2 weeks that it's taken to get pickled.
Comment here from Grant on email. He says, I made many jars of refrigerator garlic dills using cukes from the farmer's market that were picked a day or two before I pickled them. 10 days later, they are very young and a bit bitter. I've used this recipe many times, but never tasted them as early. Any thoughts on that?
And Grant confirms exactly what we were just talking about the pickling time is critical. So at 10 days, they're still a little too bitter. But if he waits another week, they'll probably be perfect. And know that there's always a bit of ish when it comes to that pickling time, because every cucumber you pickle will be different than the one you pickled the previous year.
Now, Christina, you pickle a lot of different vegetables and fruits, we learned. Is there a time of year you get extra excited for that your favorite thing to come up?
I have to tell you that I get excited about making everything, but at home, my husband is very excited because we're coming into cucumber season, and I have to make his grandmother's Polish-style refrigerator dill pickles. He salivates just thinking about it. He asked me this morning if the cucumbers were ready yet.
Oh, wow. So quickly, what is in those?
Again, it's a very great basic Milwaukee pickle recipe. So it's a combination of the vinegar, water, salt, then all the great pickling spice, which is in Milwaukee, the tradition is a combination of coriander, of clove, of bay leaf, lots of garlic, and lots of fresh dill.
Mm. Well, that sounds fantastic. I've never been this excited about pickles
Me
before.
Too. I know. I want to get going with the fridge pickles. Christina, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for everyone's questions.
That was Christina Ward. She's the master food preserver for Milwaukee County. She writes for Edible Milwaukee and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. With us to talk about pickling on this Food Friday, you can see her article on pickling for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel over at the Central Time Facebook page, along with a recipe for bread and butter pickle slices. What are you pickling next, Veronica?
I don't know. I'm just taking baby steps into this, but I think I'm going to have to start with some basic bread and butter pickles.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to go. I did radishes earlier this year, fridge pickles. Tasted
super yummy
great.
On sandwiches, I bet.
Oh, they were. Yeah. Tasted great, smelled terrible. Just overpowered the whole kitchen. I need some better
right,
containers
so maybe
or something.
Hold off on the radishes.
It only happens once in a blue moon. Tonight is actually a blue moon.
A blue moon, if you don't know, is the second full moon of a month. Usually there's just one per month, but the cycle of moons isn't exactly in sync with the calendar months. We get a second one, though, every now and then, and tonight's blue moon is the first since August 2012.
Turns out there is another kind of blue moon. Found this on the internet. Sometimes weird atmospheric conditions, ash maybe from a really big volcanic eruption or major forest fires, it can tint the atmosphere and make the moon look bluish, sometimes for a long period of time. Apparently the last recorded blue moon like that was back in 1950, so way more rare, that kind of once in a blue moon.
And of course, just talking about this, some people are going to instantly start craving blue moon ice cream, like our producer Chris Molina and our executive producer Cheryl Gasser. They both like that stuff.
Yeah, I don't need it much, but yeah, now I'm thinking about
maybe
it.
Maybe tonight.
Yeah, maybe a little blue moon ice cream. How would you make, what flavor goes into it if you made your own ice cream? Like, what is blue moon flavor?
Isn't it Fruit Loops?
Is it? So you, step one, grind up Fruit Loops. Freeze. Yeah, I have no idea either.
I don't know. Something pickled to put on top of it, maybe.
Maybe.
Pickled fruit and
pickled
blue moon
strawberries,
ice cream.
Yeah. Well, of course, tonight might be your chance to find love according to the song. Here's Billie Holiday on Central Time.
Blue moon. You saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.